Secrets. Only secrets. St. Louis Magazine just came out with an issue on secrets. There's articles on secret societies and secret places and secret items in restaurants, hidden house concerts and under-the-radar venues. It's a cool article, but if something appears in St. Louis Magazine, it's really not a secret. Just under-advertised. Some people say ours is the best-kept secret on the planet. And sometimes perhaps we are trying to hide it away. But the ideal is truth. The ideal is speaking truth. I want to talk about speaking truth in private relationship, personal relationships, in political or social arena, and in religion. There's an ideal that with true love, with your one true love, you will tell that person everything. The truth and honesty are essential for trust, and trust is essential for communication. There are no secrets, no lies in a good relationship. But one person said, a relationship that never ever has any arguments is one with a lot of secrets. And if you have to keep your relationship secret, then you probably should not be in that relationship. But there are things that we don't often tell one another, even in the most intimate and close of relationships. Little details of the day, of course, but other things. There are reasons that we hold things back. There are many times where I have not told my wife something because I just didn't want to deal with the emotional quality of her dealing with her response. I would tell myself that I was protecting her, maybe. And this often happens in relationships where one decides, oh, I'm going to protect the other person from the pain of learning this particular truth, a particular fact. A good guideline I read was that if finding out that you were holding something secret is just as damaging as the secret itself, then maybe you need to reveal the secret. And the longer that you hold back truths, the more, the stronger the feeling of betrayal can come where you did not reveal. But there are other things that sometimes you just need to avoid. I did hear about one guy his doctor told him that perhaps he had cancer. He has a couple of markers that indicated the possibility of cancer. He decided not to tell his spouse and was going to get some tests to prove. And then when finally it was proven that he didn't have cancer, he came and revealed it to her. She got very, very angry, very upset because he'd been hiding something from her. And he said, this is exactly why I didn't want to tell you. I didn't want you to be upset. But she was more upset because he had not trusted her. He had shown a fear of her, shown an unwillingness to communicate and to be present. But then I heard about another couple. They said the woman said that for the first decade of the marriage, she and her spouse, their lesbian couple, would always fight over every purchase that she made. If I bought a bag of cleaning supplies or about a new coat, there would be this argument about whether it fit into our budget, whether we could afford it, whether it was the right thing to purchase. Finally, she said, I had this breakthrough. I realized that if she didn't see the bill, if she didn't see exactly how much the money was, then she wouldn't be so upset about it. So I started using cash in order to shop. I would still tell her what I had purchased, but she would never see the numbers. And the numbers were what were causing her to be anxious. It was the numbers that keyed off her own fears of poverty because she'd been raised, her wife had been raised, in, her spouse had been raised in a very impoverished situation and was very anxious about money. And when there was still an honesty about the spending, but a certain detail was being left out and they stopped arguing. The arguments went away. Both of them were far more happy and they were getting along with each other. So there was, in a sense, a secret about how much a coat cost. But overall, they were seeing how much money they had, how their budget was going, what their financial state was, and they agreed to keep things hidden from one another at a certain level. There are other things, personal things, physical things, sometimes that don't need to give all the details to the person that we're close to. Sometimes a don't ask, don't tell domestic policy can stabilize relationships. The knowledge is there. It's possible to get the information if one really wanted to, but you don't need to talk about every single thing. The biggest reason that people hide things from someone, especially in a close relationship, is not just that they're trying to protect the other person, but really they're trying to protect themselves. They're trying to avoid the unpleasantness of having to deal with negative emotions or an unpleasant, difficult situation. But sometimes it's because we're practicing denial about who we are, who we really are. There's a singer named Mary Lambert. There's a popular song that's come out in the last year called Secrets. And she said, "They tell us from the time we're young to hide the things that we don't like about ourselves inside ourselves." And then she reflects on that. "I know I'm not the only one who spent so long attempting to be someone else." That denial of who you are, that fear and judgment against who you are causes you to try to not be yourself, to hate yourself, to dislike yourself. Maybe if you're hiding something away, what you really need to do is not hide that fact, but face it, deal with it, confront it. In the song, she says, "I'm over it. I don't care if the world knows what my secrets are. So what?" It's a movement from self-hatred and self-denial to an openness. Now, I don't know if you should be so totally open publicly about all the little things about yourself. But what the point is that she's gotten rid of that fear. In Alcoholics Anonymous, they say, you're only as sick as your secrets. It's a way of acknowledging that one of the major drivers of any addiction, any addictive behavior, usually is some element of deceit, usually self-deceit, but also trying to deceive others, trying to hide what you're doing. Someone who often alcoholics are trying to hide the fact that they're using the alcohol all the way, all the time in order to control their emotional lives. And there's something powerful about facing who you are. I know many people who've been part of Alcoholics Anonymous who try to be assiduously honest all the time because they're afraid that if they start being deceitful in any part of their lives, that it will lead them back to that same sort of deceitful, self-deceiving behavior and deceiving of others that fueled their alcohol addiction. It's a way of coming to claim who you are, understand who you are, and then work and through and develop your character. You're only as sick as your secrets. Your relationship will become sickened by secrets. So it's essential to at least create the possibility of honesty, first beginning with being honest with yourself. That self-honesty is absolutely essential in self-development and self-mastery. Self-culture, which is part of our way of religion. Then there's this whole thing in Mary Lambert about not worrying about how the world judges her. I don't care if the world knows what my secrets are. There's a big tension, a generational tension right now between younger and older people. People who have been raised with the internet, raised with things with Facebook, are much more comfortable about having their personal stuff be out in the open and much less careful about things like privacy. They don't understand the ways in which openness can be used against you. They don't understand the ways in which too much information out in the public sphere can be used to harm you politically, take away your job, take away your home, take away your position in society. We know how dangerous it is to be judged. Those of us who are gay or lesbian or different in our gender identity, we know what this judgment of society can do to our lives, to our own sense of self and integrity. There's a recent study that came out in which two psychologists were looking at couples. They went to same-sex couples, and they were looking at honesty within those relationships. They had this idea that perhaps the fact that gay and lesbian people especially were often hiding who they were, practicing this hiding of who they were in public, that that would feed back into their private relationships. And they found that there was a correlation. There seemed to be a greater tendency for gay and lesbian couples to be a little less honest with each other, or to hide certain things, be willing to hide, become more comfortable about hiding things in their own relationships because they are practicing this in public life. I don't know if any of you saw the halftime show at the Super Bowl, but apparently that was a big Black Lives Matter event, if you read social media. In a way, it was. It was bringing out certain elements and aspects in the lyrics Beyoncé was singing. It was a way of making public certain elements. And it was good to see on social media people talking about these issues. Last night I saw a little piece on Saturday Night Live where they had a little skit about a movie that was coming out entitled The Day That Beyoncé Turned Black. There are these things that we don't talk about in society. There are things that we hide. There are powerful, powerful truths, but we're uncomfortable with them. We're embarrassed about them. We don't like them, especially in America. We don't like the fact that racism causes some people to suffer more than others, or causes others to get advantages that some will not have, that minorities will not have. We don't want to talk about these things. We want to hide them away, and they become secrets and they gnaw at the inside of our society. It's good to bring them out. And then we have presidential candidates who are also bringing out some of the other stuff, bringing it out into the open. And some of the appeal of certain presidential candidates is that instead of being very good politicians, showing a concern for other people's feelings and a very careful, balanced engagement with the issues, they're willing to just say stuff that people are thinking. And I used to, when I would hear people saying incendiary things like all Muslims should be banned, invoking this sort of racial and religious hatreds at a political level, and not as if there was no danger in doing that. I remember the first time I heard some of that stuff, I wanted to say, that shouldn't happen. We should shut that down. We should tell people they can't say things like that. And a wiser, older man told me, no, you want to hear that stuff. That's the great power of democracy, is that we put stuff out in the open so that you know what the crazy stuff is. You know what the things are that people very rationally and reasonably believe are true. And then you're able to speak to those truths with your own truths, to engage in dialogue, to bring it out into the open. This is essential. Not leaving the evils of society, the prejudice of society in secret. To bring them out defangs them a little bit. They can, of course, gain political power. They can, of course, gain political ascendancy. And so it's essential that we engage in open dialogue rather than trying to repress it. There's a fine line between wanting everyone to be polite and wanting everyone to be politically correct. And we have to constantly balance the need for people to be honest about who they are and what they think with the need to show respect, understanding, tolerance. To listen to one another requires that we trust one another, requires that we be able to believe that the judgment of the other person will not harm us. And often we're so afraid of the judgment of others that we hold things back, we hide them away. I've talked before about Charles Chauncey. I don't know if you remember Charles Chauncey. Charles Chauncey was preaching in Boston in the 1700s. And it was very late in his life that he published a book called The Mystery Hidden from Ages and Generations, drawing out of Paul's letter to the Colossians. Charles Chauncey had, through rigorous logic in religion, was disciplined. He really believed passionately in social order, and he believed in the reasonableness of social order, and he had been struggling with using reason and scholarship to understand scriptures, and he had published the results of his, or had written down the results of what he was thinking. And his arguments led to affirm that that every human being was not a depraved sinner when they were born, but had an innate moral sense, that there was innate goodness in every human being, as well as our potential for evil and selfishness. He affirmed that there was a spiritual equality of all human beings. He had a belief in human free will, and that all of these things together would lead towards a universal salvation, the possibility of universal spiritual salvation and wholeness. But he was afraid of the judgments that would come down against him. He was afraid of the consequences of the truths that he knew. He was afraid that they would undermine the social order, which was a very Calvinist social order that believed that certain people should be rich and other people should be poor, and that's the way it is. And that the people who were rich had more moral qualities than the people who were poor, and he began to see that that was wrong and it was creating evils in his society, but he had trouble speaking it. He wrote this document and he shared it with his friends, and they all referred to it as the pudding. Because it was sweet. It was a truth that he was unwilling to share for decades. But when he shared it, when he began to speak from it, he began to live more truly out of it. It created the beginnings of the Unitarian movement. And within a few decades, a very liberal and progressive understanding of both the human social order as well as religious progress became dominant in Boston. The Unitarian movement began. Just like Nathan, he understood that secrets held by people in power could undermine a community, and that especially the person who was in greatest power in that story about King David should not be abusing his power in secret ways, or else everything was at risk. All the well-being of all the people of the nation suddenly became at risk. You cannot engage in adultery and murder and think you can get away with it. And not all people are engaged in adultery and murder, but there are still evils and ills within our society. Public ills. We need to speak about them. And we speak about them from our religious understanding of what is true and what is good and what makes a difference in our lives. And the place we find that, the place we begin with, is in our own personal and intimate relationships, where we find that secrets can be harmful and destructive. And that the things that we hate the most about ourselves should not be hidden away and repressed and buried, but should be openly dealt with. It is why we teach children about comprehensive sexuality. We have a comprehensive sexuality curriculum. We've been doing this since the 50s, teaching our children as much as possible to understand about, you know, we don't tell them all the sordid details, but we make sure that they understand what it means to be gay, what it means to be in sexual relationships. We understand that there are moral consequences to those. But the more that we empower people to face who they are rather than repress and hide these realities, the healthier the decisions are that we make. So from our most personal to our more social to political, a policy of openness, a policy of character leads us to greater hope. And ultimately, it's all about love. Do we love one another? Do we trust one another? Can we avoid the damaging judgments of one another? If we can create a society that is a society of openness and understanding and tolerance, if we can bring that message out into the world and find the other people who are willing to create that kind of society, then the world will be changed, our politics will be changed, and our own private lives will be richer and more beautiful because of it. Beautiful.